Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour of the program, I've been looking forward to this show. John Carlos is with us to talk about the John Carlos story. Who could talk about it better? Those of you of a certain age will remember the Olympic runner John Carlos' decision to give a Black Power salute wearing a black socks to identify with the poor, and also wearing a necklace to have all people remember lynchings. It was a picture that, when you see it, you'll realize that it was one of the more important pictures of the 20th century. Once the national anthem began to play in Mexico City, he wore black gloves to represent strength and unity, beads around his neck to represent the history of lynching, and no shoes to symbolize the poverty that still plagues so much of Black America. The book highlights how the decision was made. Originally, the Olympic Project for Human Rights was supposed to hold a large boycott, but if you'll remember 1968, I certainly do. It was one hell of a year. There was a massacre of students by the state military in Mexico City, the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, and people were terrified. And so the Olympic boycott did not take place, but this gesture did take place. And he writes about his life leading up to that moment, why he made that kind of decision, and how his life was changed as a result of that. He has carried on with his concerns about the oppressed and the poor, spoke recently to Occupy Wall Street in New York City, and we are delighted to have John Carlos with us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you, our email is down, so don't do that. Just call us, okay? John Carlos, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm honored to be here this morning.
Yeah, it's just great to have you here. We have so much. Your life is just so interesting. But would you start, please, with the moment that you met Dr. Martin Luther King? Because it's one of those moments that you will remember forever, and you had a chance to ask him some questions and had a sense of who he was as a human being as we have honored him. I haven't talked to too many people in my lifetime who had a chance to meet with him. And he was important. So describe the meeting that took place. You're deciding whether or not you're going to boycott the Olympic Games, and who's in on the meeting but Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, originally I just returned from East Texas State University. I had some social problems down there, and I decided that I would take my wife and daughter and we'd leave East Texas. And I went back to New York. I remember that day I was helping my mother to paint the kitchen. And the phone rang, and my mom answered it, and it was Professor Harry Edwards on the phone. And he said, John, there's a very important meeting taking place, and people asked me to invite you to the meeting. I said, well, let me check with my mom. I checked with my mom. She said, that'd be fine. You can go. I went down to the Hotel New Yorker across the street from the old Madison Square Garden. And I remember looking in the lobby, because I had never been in too many of the hotels down there. It was just enormous, immaculate. I'm looking at all the furniture, thinking to myself, boy, my mama could use some of this furniture here. And as I gathered myself in the lobby, I went to the desk and I asked for the room number that I need to go to, and they gave it to me. I went upstairs, and when I knocked on the door, I was impressed, but kind of like in shock, too, because it was a smiling face that greeted me, which was Dr. Andrew Young. But yet and still, Andrew Young was, in my imagination or my mind, I thought Andrew Young was about maybe 6'3", 6'4", because he always looked that tall to me. So for me to see the actual size of his height, I was like almost in a daze, like a shock. Like, but in any case, he greeted me, welcomed me in, and there was quite a few people running around in there from SCLC. As a young individual, I just, turned in the process of turning 23. I think I turned 23 that June. I'm sitting there, and I still haven't put the dots together in terms of where I was and what was about to happen. They called you, asked me would I like to have something to drink or something to eat. And I'm sitting there kind of nervously, because you see all these adults on TV, and I hear you sitting in the room with him. I still haven't put the dots together. And they mumbling around talking, and, you know, and I'm not paying attention. And then all of a sudden, boom, the door opens, and Dr. Martin Luther King walked out of the room. Now, the first thing, I didn't know whether to just die right there or what, in the state of, like, total shock. And I'm thinking right away that my mom needed to be a bugging on my lapel or a rock in my pocket, because she just idolized Dr. King so much to the point where she used to call Dr. King God's first lieutenant he sent here to Earth. Dr. King realized that I was a little nervous and maybe even had the shock look on my face. But what he did, he was such a vibrant individual with a big person smile on his face, and he started cracking jokes to kind of relax me and anyone else that might have been, you know, a little unnerved. And I thought to myself, wow, if this guy wanted to be on a Saturday Night Live, he could do real well as a stand-up. And then we went into the context of the meeting, and the meeting was in regards to the Olympic boycott. And he actually wanted to come out and support the Olympic boycott. He actually made the statement that he wanted to be second in command. He wanted Harry Edwards to continue leadership, but he wanted to be second in command. And I guess that was due to the fact that he had so many things going on. And when the meeting was over, he asked, did I have any questions? And quite naturally, I had two questions. The first question was, because he had mentioned in the meeting that they sent him a letter and told him they had a bullet with his name on it, and he wouldn't have to wait long for it. So quite naturally, that was the first letter, the first letter of question I had to ask. And I remember wearing shades, and I remember pulling the shades down on my nose so I could look directly into his eyes through no glass, just my eyeball to his eyeball, and ask him, Dr. King, if they're threatening your life, why would you go back to Memphis? You know, and I'm looking in his eyes, and, you know, when someone tells you that someone told him they're going to take his life, you're looking to see if he has fear. No fear whatsoever, like the Rock of Gibraltar. And even when you look deeper, he had love, total love for humanity. It wasn't about his life. And I said to him, why would you go back, Dr. King? And he said, that's a good question. And the statement that he made was, John, I have to go back and stand for those that won't stand for themselves. And John, I have to go back and stand for those that can't stand for themselves. That, like, rung all the bells in my brain, because that's exactly what I was doing since the time I was a little boy. But I never had a phrase or a title or a statement that went with it. I just did it. And for him to say that, it was enormous, because I said to myself, I said, when he's going back to Memphis, he was going back for the sanitation department. That wasn't just merely for black people working for the sanitation department. I think they had all sorts of ethnic groups that was working within the sanitation department. And I found later that Dr. King did not lose his life as a result of the civil rights movement. He lost his life based on the fact that he got involved in the economics of the country. The same thing that everybody's fighting about right there in Wisconsin, same thing that Occupy Wall Street is all about. So then I asked him, the second question was, Dr. King, did you play any sports? Did you basketball? Were you a boxer? He said, that's a good question. Why you ask? I said, well, I can't understand. Why would you want to get involved in the Olympic boycott? And he stated that, he said, listen, imagine this. So imagine you out in the middle of a lake. He said, and you are sitting there and water serene and still, and then you reach down in the boat and you pick up a rock and drop the rock in the water. What happens? And I said, vibrations. He said, absolutely, waves. He said, those waves go out to the far ends of the lake. He said, well, that Olympic boycott is just like that rock. It would make a statement that would reach the ends of this earth. And not only will it reach the ends of this earth to let them know that we have some problems that we need to deal with to try and resolve, it would be in a non-violent sector. In other words, we would touch everybody by saying we're willing to sacrifice our opportunities as an Olympian to make a statement in society that we need to get on our job and try and resolve these ills that we have in society. And we wouldn't have to maim, kill, or injure anyone by doing that. And then he went on to say, do you think we'd have been as successful in the wars had the black soldiers decided merely to just say, I care not to fight or step back? He said, do you think we would have won all the wars we won? He said, the same difference with the Olympics. Would you think we would win all the medals that we win if the blacks hadn't participated? And, you know, he said, you're making a statement, and that's what it's all about, trying to bring focus and attention to have some dialogue relative to people who let their consciousness go to sleep.
And you say that when he said those words to you, it was like he joined your mind and your heart and guided them toward one direction. You became a heart and soul member of what you called the Olympic Project for Human Rights.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that was my main focus, like I said, to awaken the people. And sometimes, you know, you have to wake people by shock treatment. But yet still to wake them and provoke them into having some sort of dialogue and discussion about what was taking place in society at that time. You have to take into account that, you know, we was in some very traumatic times back in 68.
Mm-hmm.
When they had, you know, the assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. We had the Democratic Convention where all those young individuals lost their lives. We had the Vietnam War going on. We had the Black Panther movement taking place. There was a lot of things. The shooting at Kent State. Many things was taking place in that era.
And when you went into Mexico City, when you went to the Olympics, what was going on in Mexico was atrocious. Students were being killed.
Prior to us getting there, they roughly killed, I think, close to 2,000 individuals. They say it's 150. My estimation is a lot higher than, they say it's 350. My estimation is a lot higher than the 350. They killed many individual students. I could say they slaughtered many individual students. They killed so many of them, they took their bodies and threw them in there. And the incinerators, when they couldn't put any more bodies in there, they went on and took the rest of them out in the ocean and dumped them. Then they turned the guns on those that was left and made them go up into the hills and told them, do not come down until the games are over.
Mm. When did you, and we'll go back to the beginning of your life in a moment, but it's interesting that what you did and one of your teammates did and a mate from Australia did, that is forever etched in our minds, and a lot of young people are learning about what you did who don't remember because they weren't alive in 1968. But the decision to do what you did sort of evolved, wasn't it? You didn't go to Mexico City thinking, we're not boycotting this because Dr. King was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy, there's too much, you know, took the wind out of the Olympic boycott sails. But you didn't go with a plan in mind necessarily. It just kind of happened.
No, well, that's not altogether true. What happened was we had anticipated doing the boycott of a collective group of young individuals. One of the basic things that we had concern for, our demands were that South Africa and Rhodesia would be suspended from the games. The second thing was that Muhammad Ali's belt be restored. The third thing was that we would have more black coaches involved in the Olympic movement. The next thing that we was concerned about is that Avery Brundage, which in my estimation was a bigot of bigots, that was the head of the International Olympic Committee. He's the one that, you know, fostered the Olympic Games with the Mr. Hitler. So, you know, everybody knew where Avery Brundage was coming from, so we wanted him removed from the head of the International Olympic Committee. And then when this didn't take place, what they decided to do was, okay, we'll expel South Africa and Rhodesia, which watered things down. So a lot of individuals felt like, oh, we won, so let's go to the games. And what it was, actually, many young individuals in this country are trained to go after the carrot, so to speak. They're trained to, you know, put nothing before the Olympic movement. You know, there's no value in terms of moral character or vision of how we can have a better society, not merely for yourself, but for your kids and your offsprings. So therefore, when you sit back and look at those things, many individuals decided they want to go on to the games. Now, it comes to a question in my mind as to whether I'm going to boycott the Olympic Games. And I remember having a discussion with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, telling him, say, well, Kareem, if I was you, I wouldn't go. I said, and based on the fact that you are the NBA, the NBA is riding on your shoulders. All you have to do is say you're going back to school. Kareem chose not to go. But for John Carlos, it was a little different. I didn't have the NBA or the track world behind me where I was going to be able to make me a living for my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to take into account that had I decided to boycott the Olympic Games, the United States at that time was the number one country in the world in track and field. And I felt like another American would come and earn my spot on the Olympic team, win him a medal. I didn't think that he would represent John Carlos the way he wanted to be represented on the victory stand. So it's imperative that I go on to the games. Now, once we've gone through the rounds and so forth and getting ready for that final race, Mr. Smith and I got together and we decided that we were disenchanted with the fact that the boycott was called off and something needed to be done. I wanted to make a statement. Mr. Smith was with that, and the rest is history. We came together with the artifacts that you mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, about the beads, the scarf, the black shirt, the socks, no shoes. And then again, at the same time, I wore my clothes out there out of order, so to speak, because I was concerned about all the blue-collar workers of this country. My mom and dad were blue-collar workers. We wanted to acknowledge them on that victory stand, too. And that's why I was out of protocol the way I was dressed.
And tell us about Peter Norman, the Australian. Why did he decide to join you?
Well, first of all, because Peter Norman was a man's man. Peter Norman could make his own decisions about, you know, what he felt was happening in society. When you sit back and think about South Africa, you know, Australia was, you know, pretty close to the South African views at that time relative to the Aboriginal people. So, you know, when you sit back and take all that into account, Peter said, I have a decision to make. Well, we all were at the crossroads of our lives in terms of making very pertinent decisions. And he just felt like, yes, I believe in human rights, and I support what you guys are doing. And he chose to wear a button, Olympic Project for Human Rights. Now, mind you, with Mr. Norman, you take into account how brave the individual was, because when we got back to the States, you know, Mr. Smith and I went through hell. They would whip up on Mr. Smith at one time, and they said, we tired of beating up on Mr. Smith. Let's go cross town and find John Carlos and whip up on him. Well, they could switch back and forth on us, but when Peter Norman went back to Australia, there was no switching up. They whipped on him 24/7. Mm. And I always love, respect, and honor Peter as my brother, not just my friend or an associate, for the mere fact that while this was taking place, Peter never denounced us. He never walked away from us. He never changed his mind about what was going on, and he took what he did to his grave as a man.
Other people who supported you, one of my heroes, many people's heroes, baseball heroes, Jackie Robinson.
Well, Mr. Robinson, you know, when I was a kid, I had the good fortune to meet Jackie Robinson. My father used to have, like, the ballroom crap game and poker game, you know, and a lot of the baseball players back at that time used to come through and entertain us. And my father introduced me to Jackie Robinson as a youngster. I wonder if Jackie Robinson knew later in life that I was the same kid that he'd come into my father's shoe shop. But in any case, when I met Jackie Robinson, a couple of years had gone by, and they had a movie called The Jackie Robinson Story. And if you remember, Jackie Robinson played his own role in that movie. And I recall going there, me and a buddy of mine, and, you know, when they turn the lights out, you know, kids want to play around. And I just happened to scan the screen while I'm playing. I said, oh, that's my daddy's friend. That's my father's friend. My father said, oh, you kidding? I said, no, that's my father's friend. But then I got serious about watching the movie and realized, as great as Jackie Robinson was as a baseball player, as great as he was as a college athlete, student, as great as he was in the military, and then you sit back and think about the racial strife that he had to go through, you know, mm-hmm. the bias and the prejudice that he had amongst the people that he represented in the city of New York, or the South where he had to go play, amongst some of his teammates that didn't want blacks on the team. And I'm saying to myself at a very early age, if this is a man, this great to do so many wonderful things, and he's penalized and pushed back merely because of the color of his skin, if it could happen to him, it can happen to anybody, and somebody's got to get on the job to change this.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're talking with, telling his story, the John Carlos story, which has just been published, is John Carlos. And a remarkable story it is. Tommy Smith and John Carlos and a track guy from Australia, too, who died not that long ago. And it was quite a big thing for Peter Norman, the Australian, to join them. It's the moment, the gesture, what was worn on the feet, was what was worn around the neck, what was worn on the hands, a gesture that resonated across the globe. And it was not fully embraced by everybody. He received bullets in the mail, and it was a moment that was incredibly dramatic. Those alive during that time will remember it extremely vividly. And if you see the picture, it brings you right back to that time. John Carlos is with us. The book is The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. And we should also tell you, he's quite an engaging speaker, as you can tell. He, this Thursday, is going to be in Madison. I would highly recommend that you meet him. It's a book discussion and signing at the Wisconsin Book Festival, Madison Public Library, 7:30 to 9. That's on Mifflin Street in Madison this Thursday. John Carlos will be there, and if I lived in Madison, I'd be there too. But I live in Milwaukee. Maybe I'll come to Milwaukee sometime, and I'll be there. Our number is 800-486-8655, and you haven't heard anything about his early life, which is just phenomenal, so we'll get to that. He really wanted to be a swimmer, but the color of his skin created problems. He'll talk about that in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Carlos, here to tell us the John Carlos story this hour. And we go to phone calls, starting with John in Eagle River. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you all?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. What I remember, I'm actually 69, so I'm guessing you're pretty close to my age. And I remember watching when you and your cohorts raised your fist. And one of the things that impressed me, I was actually working in the black community in Chicago for 5 of those years during that period, and it really made a lot of the people I was working with very proud. But I remember that at least you and your other black partner in that bowed your head, and I wondered what that was all about. And then the other thing is, I was the next year in 69, I was down in Mexico studying Spanish. And I wondered how you guys ran in that soupy air, because I couldn't breathe down there.
Well, the first part of your question, we bowed our heads, man, and sorrow and sadness, man, that we had to come to this point to try and bring attention to America, that it needs to look at itself in terms of trying to deal with the issues that they were constantly trying to sweep up under the rug.
And what about running in Mexico? Was it hard, John?
Oh, it was no problem whatsoever. I think the effect was more for individuals that ran the distance races, anywhere from a half mile up. Many individuals was having problems. Even the individuals that would run around at that time with the cameras on their neck, trying to take the pictures of all the different events, they were passing out as well. But it basically didn't affect the sprinters.
And tell us a little bit about the immediate reaction. In the preface to the book, it's written that the Brent Musburger, who was writing for the Chicago American, wrote...
forgive me, but I don't talk about Brent Musburger.
Oh, you don't want to do that?
I don't have anything to say about Brent Musburger, other than the fact that when this thing is said and done, when Brent Musburger dies 15 minutes after he's dead, he'll never be mentioned again. So in end result, based on what he said, I will be remembering history for the duration.
Huh. What about the response, though? Tell me about the people who supported what you did and those who were incredibly threatened by what you did to the point of threatening your life.
Well, there was many people that felt like they were being recognized by what we did. As I stated earlier, you know, many people tried to come up and say that this was a black power salute. And you have to bring it to their attention 43 years later that it was an Olympic project for human rights. It didn't say Olympic project for blacks. It said for human rights. Now, those individuals that was against us, that controlled the media, the newspaper, the radio, the television, those individuals were the ones that cast it in terms of being a black power demonstration, which threw a lot of fear into a lot of people. A lot of people that were supposed to be liberal, it threw fear into their hearts because they were seeing something that they never anticipated ever in their lives. But yet and still, you know, we survived because it was many other people that told me, say, I fully understand. And when I say many other people, I'm talking about across the board, not just merely black people, but it was many white people that felt it was necessary to make this statement. And then what they did, they basically whitewashed that era. They whitewashed it all out so these young kids that was coming up, next generation or two, they had no knowledge whatsoever about this demonstration. Even to the point where if you sat back and looked at world records that we set back at those games, you sit back and say maybe that might be why individuals turn their heads to the drug situation now so these records can be wiped out of the record books. Because it's very difficult to say these individuals didn't exist. And when all the youngsters look in the record books, they see guys' names there that they have no history on, but knowing that it was the greatest Olympics of all time, which was Mexico City. So, you know, we survived from both ends. We had those that was the haters, and then we had those that were the supporters.
Yeah. John, thanks for the call. Jack in Chicago. Hi, Jack.
How you doing there? It's an honor to speak to this man. I ran track and field at the same time he did, but got nowhere close to him. I just wanted to mention that what you did is what I'm down in Chicago right now doing, trying to convince people to interrupt the narrative and to, you know, stick up the black fist that nobody expected to happen, which got everybody's attention. And it's just the thing about your medals, I never got clear whether you got them or not, but the thing is they can't take away the time and your performance that day, no matter what they try to do.
Well, they made a statement about they were going to take our medals. That's something that they tried to put out, that they was going to take our medals, and I had to make it clear to them that you didn't give me this medal. You set a standard for me to meet. I met the standard, qualified for the team. You didn't give me a medal. I had to earn my rounds to make that victory stand. So if you thought you were going to take John Collins' medal, I told them, you better bring the militia. The medal doesn't mean anything to John Collins. Medals never did. But this particular medal might mean everything to my kids. So if you want this medal, you come with the militia to get it, because you're going to have a fight on your hands. So what they did for 43 years, they propagandized and told the world that they'd taken our medals to intimidate any young athletes that might come after us, because they've been trained to go after the goal or to go for the medal. Now, if you step out of the circle, we're going to penalize you, and we're going to take that medal away. So they held a lot of athletes in bay by making that statement for 40 years, 40-plus years, that they had taken our medals away. Absolute lie, absolute nonsense.
Hmm. Thank you, Jack, for the call. We got to spend some time on your early life because it's fascinating. And let's talk about swimming. You really could have gone to the Olympics in swimming, but the color of your skin kept you from doing that.
Absolutely. I believe that I was a far better swimmer than I was a runner. You know, I heard about this individual swimming in English Channel at one time on the radio. That was our TV back then. And I recall this guy swimming in English Channel, and I went to my dad, and I said, Pop, I said, can you swim? He said, yes, son, just like a rock, straight to the bottom. So I was impressed with the fact that he said, I can't swim. But I felt that I could swim very good. And I asked him questions, well, Dad, isn't there sharks in the channel? How does this guy swim? How does he fight up the sharks? He swim with a knife in his mouth. What happens when he needs to go to the restroom? What happens? You know, I was wanted answers. Well, in the meantime, while my father went to find the answers to come back to give me some sort of reasonable understanding, they started talking about the Olympic Games. Oh, Pop, what's the Olympic Games? He said, son, that's where the greatest athletes in the world come together to show their wares, to see who is more physically fit. And then it's nation against nation. They produce their best athletes for this Olympic Games. So then I left the thought of swimming the English Channel and began to focus on the Olympics. I said, Pop, have they had any black swimmers in the Olympics? He said, no, son, no blacks from America. And I began with the theory that I would be the first black swimmer to represent America, the first black. And I started to build this within my system, my spirit, my mind. And I remember one day my father said, son, we need to have a talk. By that time, I was maybe 13 years old. We need to have a talk. And I said, about what, Daddy? He said, son, you'll never be able to go to the Olympics as a swimmer. And I said, why not, Daddy? I'm good. I'm the best in the city. He told me, he said, yeah, son. He said, but what he did, he took his finger and he rubbed up against his skin. And I'm thinking that maybe he had itch or something, you know. And he said to me, son, you won't be able to go because of the color of your skin. And I said, well, you talking about the color of my skin? He said, yes, son. He said, where would you go train? He said, you can't go to the Harlem River. You lose your friends every summer. He said, you can't go to the public pool. Everybody's trying to cool off. You can't go to the ocean. It's too rough. Where would you go? Just then, I'm thinking about joining the club. Then he went back to his hand again. He said, because of the color of your skin, they won't let you join a swim club. So then he says to me, he says, son, you remember when you and your buddies would climb through the mountains and go up to where the white area is? He said, what would happen when you guys got up in there and jumped in the water? And I remember, just a matter of seconds, all the white folks would get up and call their kids out of the water. Betty, Bobby, punch, get out the water, hurry up, hurry up. And for me at that time was very revealing to me, because I'm sitting back and I'm saying, 1 minute they don't want to be like me, like something going to roll off me and get on them, and then the very next minute I'm looking at everybody on the deck trying to get their suntan to look like me. So I was very confused at what was going on at that particular time. But yet and still, from 1957, 58, up until 1980 or 88, it took that long before America actually had a black swimmer to go and represent them and win a gold medal.
Isn't that something? But what's incredible, John, is that then you become a runner. You make it in the Olympics as a runner, and I want to hear that part of the story. Is it because of your being the Robin Hood of Harlem that you became an Olympic track guy?
That's absolutely right. Robin Hood was very inspirational to me as a kid on TV. And I think he was the inspiration to any kid, any ghetto in the world, based on the fact that Robin Hood, so to speak, split the pea. His attitude was, there's two laws. There's man's law and there's God's law. He pursued God's law to say everybody deserves an equal shot to exist in this world and be comfortable. I felt that many individuals in my neighborhood at that particular time was drugs were put upon them. Drugs came down into Harlem like overnight. Like somebody said, we're going to use Harlem as a test program. So many of my friends that I was going to school with, their parents got involved in drugs. Their brothers and sisters got involved in drugs. Many of them did not have food in their households. Many of them didn't have clothes. And then I got to thinking about Robin Hood and thinking about they got those freight trains coming in by the Yankee Stadium every day. And let me go peekaboo and see what they have.
And I
realized that, you know, they had stuff that could suffice the needs of these individuals. Somebody had to do it. And at the same time, I had to be very careful, because my father and mother were no-nonsense people. They didn't want to do anything outside the norm of America. But then I felt I was compelled to try and help where I could. And one day, as I stated earlier, my father used to have the rodent poker game and crap game. And these two detectives knew my father real well from those games. And they went to my dad and told him, said, Earl, there's some break-ins, and we think Johnny's doing it, and you need to tell him. My father stopped him right there and said, no, you need to tell him. That's your job. And he directed them over to where the new Yankee Stadium is built now. It used to be called McCoon's Park. That's where we had our track meets. And I was in there that day, actually over there to get some new Converse sneakers from the guys that could afford them. You know, we'd get my old shoes and take their new Converse. Anyway, they circled the park, and they rolled up on me and two of my friends, and they told my friends to go sit at the gate. And they told me, said, come here, John, we need to talk to you. And they took me out in the middle of the field and told me, said, there's been some break-ins. We think we know who's doing these break-ins, and we're going to catch them. We can't do anything until we catch them, but we are going to catch them. Now, Mr. Lester was about 6 feet. Mr. Brown was about 6'6". So Mr. Lester said, oh, and by the way, you have a talent. And I said to him, I said, what talent is that? He said, you're a runner. When he said I was a runner, I kind of smirked. And Mr. Bryant smacked me upside my head so hard, I could see his fingers on the other side of my jaw. And he said, don't disrespect Mr. Lester. And I said, I'm not disrespecting Mr. Lester, Mr. Bryant. But he said, I was a runner. I said, everybody in the neighborhood can run. I said, if a woman got a purse snatch, she'll run the purse snatch and I'll get a purse back. Huh. I'm nobody special. And they said, no, you are special.
Huh.
And they gave me a number to the New York Pioneer Club.
Oh, John,
that's
a story.
Where my career started.
What a story. What a story. Our number is 800-486-8655. John Carlos, whose story is in the John Carlos Story, is with us this hour. Art in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. It's really a great honor to talk with you. I'm wondering to what degree you are aware of or inspired by Paul Robeson. As you may know, he was... He broke the color line at Rutgers. He was an All-American football player.
Oh, I know quite a bit about Mr. Robinson. Mr. Robinson is one of the household heroes. I mean, not just mere fact that he broke the color barrier in some areas, but just the fact that he was a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, he was an actor. He was a singer. He was an entertainer. He was a poet. Paul Robeson had the whole package. And most of all, the foremost, is the fact that Paul Robeson loved the fact that he was a black man and proud of the fact that he was a black man, and he wanted to carry, you know, the torch forward in terms of getting equality for black people and all people. The fact that the government ridiculed him and took his passport away and this and that, didn't stop him from his beliefs and his goal to try and make it a better society.
Thank you, Art, for your call. Tell us about your vivid memories of Malcolm X, John.
Well, Malcolm X is a unique situation. You know, back to the radio again, I remember hearing Malcolm X on the radio, and the things that Malcolm X was saying was pretty much like me. Everyone was going downstream, and I was always going upstream. The same thing in terms of his vernacular, you know, in terms of his dialect or his conversation. Everyone was going downstream, and he was going upstream. He was very sure of himself in terms of who he was as a black man. He was trying to instill black pride in a lot of individuals and letting them know at the same time that they had rights and they had to pursue their rights and they had to get a little stronger. Now, I had an opportunity to go and hear him in person when he moved to New York to the mosque in New York to head it up. And he used to give these speeches every week, and I would go down there the first time. The first time I went down there and saw him, you know, I was actually mesmerized. I was mesmerized for two reasons. The first reason was I anticipated him being a dark-skinned fella, but Malcolm X was a fair-skinned individual. And I sat back and I looked at him and I said, wow, you know, most light-skinned individuals don't be blowing black like he was blowing black. But I was intrigued totally about the things that he was saying and how sure he was of himself, to the point where I began to stay there after the meeting was over, the lectures were over, just so I can run with him. I would have to jog because he was a very fast walker. I would jog with him just to try and get whatever extra knowledge I can get from one location to the next. That was my thing. I would make sure that I stayed there after so I can just have that opportunity to jog through the street with him when he was going to his next meeting place.
Mm. And then when he was assassinated, you thought, you knew you were fast, you could run, that perhaps your speed could have done something to save him?
At least for 20 years or more, I was torn about that because I made a statement to him that I wasn't going to be able to go to the Audubon Ballroom that Sunday because I was going to take a driving test that Monday trying to get my New York driver's license. So we got in the car and we drove up to Buffalo, New York. Well, at least we were headed to Buffalo, New York. And just as we passed West Point, it came across the news that Malcolm X was shot. Now, they didn't say he was assassinated at that time. He was just shot. And, I mean, I guess we broke all kind of records getting back to the city. And by the time I got back there, everyone was walking around the street crying and just milling around with tears, said he had died. And that had a bad effect on me because I felt, had I been in that Audubon Ballroom, I could have did something to try and prevent him from losing his life. But, you know, I'm going to tell you something. That the most remarkable thing about hearing Dr. King both is I think both of them knew that they were so close to death, but they felt that the cause that they were standing for was far greater than their lives.
Yeah. John, have you been to the King Memorial yet in Washington?
No, you know, unfortunately, I was there in D.C. I didn't get a chance to go over and see it, but that would be my first goal next time I get back to D.C. To go to the memorial.
Yeah, mine too. I'm anxious to see it. John Carlos is our guest this hour. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The sports moment that changed the world, the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. You remember what he did. If you were alive, you really remember. If you see the picture, your memories will go exactly back to that day. And if you weren't alive, it's quite a story, and he's told the story of his life in this book. It's a heck of a life. Lines are open if you want to join us, or if you just want to listen, that's fine. 800-486-8655. John is going to be in Madison this Thursday, 2 days from now, for a book discussion and signing. It should be a great event at the Wisconsin Book Festival. That's the Madison Public Library, 201 West Mifflin Street, from 7:30 until 9. I think it sounds like an event that you would like to be a part of. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. John Carlos is our guest. I know that just a little while ago you were at the Occupy Wall Street microphone in New York City. Can you talk about why you were there, what you said, and what you think about this worldwide protest, John?
Well, I told the people, basically, I'm there because, for them. and told them, why am I there for them? Because I am them. You know, my policies back in 1968 is the same and relevant to these young individuals' policies today. They're looking for a fair shake from the powers to be, from the heavy rollers in this society. They're tired of the point that we're losing our jobs constantly. While we're losing our jobs, their bank account is constantly growing. Our kids can't go to college because of the cost of education has gone up. Those individuals that did go to college, they can't find work. Plus, they're still getting in the mail. Those student loans need to be paid. Many individuals are losing their houses. You know, when you sit back and think about it, it's not a color thing. Where we were fighting against these issues back in 68. Now all ethnic groups are fighting these issues across this country. When you sit back and think about what's happening in your own state right here, it's ridiculous that people would think that we should have a closed eye to those individuals that are suffering, particularly those individuals that made this country what it is today. The working people are the ones, the blue-collar people are the ones that made this country as great as it's been. Now we're the ones that's going to take the load and take the loss. People are saying enough is enough, and that's exactly what we were saying in 68. That's exactly what they're saying in 2011. So I applaud, you know, Occupy Wall Street and all the other satellites that's involved.
Matt in La Crosse. Hi, Matt.
Hi. First, I just wanted to say thanks for having this guest on. This is amazing, and thanks for all that you've done for us as a people. Second, I would just like to ask the question. You know, we've seen it fit to do away with horribly racist things like Little Black Sambo, and I just wanted to bring up another big issue of racism in sports today, and that's, so we've seen it do away with those. We still have these racist imagery of Indian mascots and logos, which, you know, in the Native world is almost completely united against, and I just kind of want your comments on that a little bit, and then also maybe why so many African Americans continue to play for teams that support that racist imagery and haven't really come out against it. I know some have, but so many people haven't. And
all right, thank you for the question, John.
Well, first of all, as far as the logos and images, there are people that are striking out against it. How they use the Indian, the American Indian, as various mascots for various teams. There are people that's challenging them on that. Another thing relative to, we talk about the institution of education, think about all the logos that's being sold around the country on the backs of these young individual athletes, where the NCAA is making enormous amounts of money, and these individuals are not being able to support their families. And then when you sit back and think about the individuals that's there today, that's not stepping out to make the various statements, you have to take into account, as I said earlier, our area, they whitewashed. They whitewashed our area to the point where they didn't want young individuals to know that they had the right to use their minds in terms of whatever would concern them socially. You can't be concerned about just merely yourself when your mom is doing bad or your brother or sister is doing bad or the individual you went to school with is doing bad just merely because you're getting a fat paycheck. So now my suggestion to any young individuals is this is your day and this is your time, but you have to realize who the man in the mirror is first, the woman in the mirror. I got to get in touch with myself. Then I can understand as to what depths I have relative to what is taking place in society right now, whether I'm strong enough to step up and make a statement, whether I'm strong enough to say, no, this will no longer continue, whether I'm strong enough to say values and morals and respect is far greater to me than money right now.
Thanks, Matt. Charles in Door County, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
When your situation occurred, at any time in what you did you think about one other individual besides yourself who I thought were probably the two most outstanding individuals who demonstrated at the Olympics in their own manner and who had a profound effect upon it, and that was Jesse Owens?
Yeah, Jesse Owens talked to you about what you were going to do, and I think you described him as being from the old school, John.
Well, you know, when you sit back and you say Jesse Owens, did Jesse Owens demonstrate or did Jesse Owens compete? I think Jesse Owens competed.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've stated, Jesse Owens did come from the old school. Jesse Owens is one guy that believed in the theory that just give us a little more time and things will change. Well, before Jesse Owens left this world, he realized the same thing that I realized earlier, that time has run out. I mean, you know, you can't just, you know, sit back and say, I'm afraid to offend my oppressor. In other words, if you have your foot on my neck and I can't breathe, I'm afraid to tell you to get off my neck because I don't want to offend you. Jesse Owens had to come to realization in that. We always loved Jesse Owens and respected Jesse Owens as an athlete, but we also stated that Jesse, had you stood up in 1936, and we wouldn't have to come back 32 years later and do what we're doing.
I want to spend just a moment because, you know, sometimes you take these big actions. You come back, you write by 1969 and into 1970 after the Olympics. Your life was, which is amazing, beg, borrow, and steal. If you had $100, you would leave your family and hightail it to Vegas and hit the crap tables to see if you could...
The crap table or the blackjack table, that's right.
Well, what was going on? You had no money?
No, well, you know, like, when you sit back and think about it, going into the Olympic Games, the sun was shining very bright for us. But by the time we exited the Olympic Games, we were in the midst of an amazing storm. You know, lightning, thunder, fireworks, everything was thrust upon the two individuals or the three individuals that was involved in that demonstration. So therefore, there was no jobs available for you. If you had any money in the bank, all your money is being depleted. And a lack of money brings a lot of contempt into a household. Kids was being abused and misused in school, mainly because they were my kids, or Mr. Smith's kids. So we had strife all around us. There wasn't no easy pickings. My first wife couldn't take it anymore. She took her life as a result of what was taking place. But like I say, I would never add nor take anything away. You know, I'm sorry to say my wife died. If my life had to go, it was far greater than the cause is far greater than my life or her life or anyone's life relative to trying to make change for society.
Oh, John. Let's go to Kathy in Oshkosh. Hi, Kathy.
Thank you for this program. Mr. Carlos, I want you to know that at the time of your fist raising, my dad and I were in the living room watching, and he said quietly that he just couldn't see this. And I had become enamored of Black history for about 5 years, and I said, I think he did the right thing. And it was very quiet, that's all we said, but I want you to know it did have a very good impact in our house.
Thank you very much. Many people have come to that understanding as well. You know, I think anything can be proved itself out in time. That's the main thing. We had to endure the time for many people to have an open mind and start to recognize that not only did we bring a demonstration, but we brought the correct demonstration to bring attention to the plight of people of color or the plight of this society in which we live.
Yeah. What do you, other than writing this book, which I'm glad you wrote, it's good. It's good you did this in your lifetime. People will eat up this story, I'm sure.
Let me just say what kind of cemented my soul early. As a youngster, I was born and raised on Lenox Avenue, and the good fortune is that I was born and raised between the two of the greatest entertainment facilities on the planet at that time, which was the Savoy Ballroom and the Cotton Club. So many of the great entertainers, black and white, used to come and perform there. And to open my windows at night when the hawk was out there, when I say the hawk, I mean that bad weather. I remember my brother and I would have debates or arguments about whether the window should be open, whether we could hear the music through the window. But the greats, you know, like Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra's, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, John Basie, all these individuals would come to these two different clubs and perform. That music is something that kind of cemented my soul and kept a calm within me in the midst of a storm.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us, John Carlos. It's a heck of a book. It's just terrific, and thank you.
Hey, may I make one statement also?
Please.
If anyone's interested, they can go to my page, johncarlos.org.
Okay.
In the next 10 days or so, we anticipate having a raffle. I'm going to raffle off 10 books, 10 autographed books to 10 lucky winners, as well as I'm going to have a poster that I'm going to raffle off with the autographs of Tommy Smith, Peter Norman, and John Carlos. And that's a really unique poster to have in your in your archives.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one to have. Thank you so much, John.
And thank you, and God bless.
Yeah, you too. JohnCarlos.org is his website. That's be nice to have that poster. The book is The John Carlos Story. How can you ask someone to live in the world and not have something to say about injustice? And again, a reminder, he's going to be at the Madison Public Library. Go to this event. It's going to be great. Thursday, October 20th for a book discussion and signing, 7:30 until 9 p.m. I also need to tell you, you know, you got to just pledge now because it was a terrific hour and you don't hear this kind of conversation anywhere else. We did have, and thank you so much, more than 9,000 people pledged during our Half the Time pledge drive. We're almost at the amount of money that we need to have raised. Not quite, but almost there. So it's not too late to pledge and help pay for the programs you count on. If you want to do that now, that would be great. WPR.org or 888-202-2889. Anita Hill is with us tomorrow. There's a story as well. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and for on-air production.